Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. What comes after death? Heaven? Hell? Nothing? More life? My guest this hour, a top neuroscientist, has been thinking about options. He's come up with 40 visions of afterlife. Is he right? Who knows? But he'll sure get you thinking. This hour on Point, 40 ways of thinking about the afterlife. You can join the conversation. How do you picture it? Something? Nothing? Heavenly choirs? People have been speculating for a long, long time in books and movies. Here from 1978, Heaven Can Wait, a confused football player played by Warren Beatty finds himself in the afterlife before his time. A heavenly official, played by James Mason, explains where he is.
This is not a dream. Life has a certain quality all its own, a certain feeling, and so do dreams. You know that this is not life. And you know now that this is not a dream. This is a place that comes after life and after dreams.
Heaven Can Wait, 1978, but ultimately it doesn't wait. We end up somewhere, or do we? Joining me now from Houston, Texas, is David Eagleman. He's a neuroscientist at the Baylor College of Medicine, where he directs the Laboratory for Perception and Action and the Initiative on Neuroscience and Law. His new book is Some, that's S-U-M, Some, 40 Tales from the Afterlives. David Eagleman, thank you for joining us.
Hello, Tom. Good to be here.
It's great to have you. We want to hear a lot of these 40, as many as we can jam in this hour. Read us one right off the bat, would you? What have you got?
Okay, I'll start with Circle of Friends.
You've got 40 of these. They're vignettes. Each one imagines the afterlife or an afterlife. Quite different. Some kind of heavenly, some kind of hellish, some in between. Circle of Friends. Let's hear it.
That's right. When you die, you feel as though there were some subtle change, but everything looks approximately the same. You get up and brush your teeth. You kiss your spouse and kids and leave for the office. There's less traffic than normal. The rest of your building seems less full, as though it's a holiday. But everyone in your office is here, and they greet you kindly. You feel strangely popular. Everyone you run into is someone you know. At some point, it dawns on you that this is the afterlife. The world is only made up of people you've met before. It's a small fraction of the world population, about 0.0002%, but it seems like plenty to you. It turns out that only the people you remember are here, so the woman with whom you shared a glance in the elevator may or may not be included. Your second grade teacher is here, with most of the class, your parents, your cousins, and your spectrum of friends through the years, all your old lovers. Your boss, your grandmothers, and the waitress who served your food each day at lunch. Those you dated, those you almost dated, those you longed for. It's a blissful opportunity to spend quality time with your 1,000 connections, to renew fading ties, to catch up with those you let slip away. It's only after several weeks of this that you begin to feel forlorn. You wonder what's different as you saunter through the vast, quiet parks with a friend or two. No strangers grace the empty park benches. No family unknown to you throws breadcrumbs for the ducks and makes you smile because of their laughter. As you step into the street, you note there are no crowds, no buildings teeming with workers, no distant cities bustling, no hospitals running 24/7 with patients dying and staff rushing, no trains howling into the night with sardined passengers on their way home. Very few foreigners. You begin to consider all the things unfamiliar to you. You've never known, you realize, how to vulcanize rubber to make a tire. And now those factories stand empty. You've never known how to fashion a silicon chip from beach sand, how to launch rockets out of the atmosphere, how to pit olives or lay railroad tracks. And now those industries are shut down. The missing crowds make you lonely. You begin to complain about all the people you could be meeting, but no one listens or sympathizes with you because this is precisely the life you chose when you were alive.
David Eagleman, reading from Some 40 Tales from the Afterlives. And here's one where what? You die, and the afterlife is you're still kind of there, but only surrounded by the people that you met in life, those you reached out to. In other words, you sort of made your own afterlife by your choices of who you connected with.
That's right. The thing I need to emphasize up front is this book is literary fiction, so none of these are real proposals about the afterlife. Instead, they're all different angles on our own life. They offer different ways, lenses of looking at what's going on with our life. And they're meant to be funny and thought-provoking. As a scientist, I'm not making any sort of real proposal for what I think happens after we die. What I am emphasizing in the book, though, is the importance of the exercise of thinking about possibilities. So this is the reason that I've written the book is in the last few years, a lot of scientists have gotten a lot of publicity writing books about the new atheism.
Mm-hmm. And Dawkins and Hitchens and Sam Harris and all the rest.
Precisely, precisely. And these guys are incisive and insightful, and they've done a wonderful job of showing the problems with current religions. It's sort of there are lots of things to criticize with current religions, unfortunately. One of the main issues being that everybody believes very fervently in whatever they grew up with, and it seems that all other religions are patently ridiculous from their point of view.
Maybe, though that's not what polls say about how Americans think about it, but you're not coming at this as an atheist, as I read you, David.
Yeah, well, so here's the funny thing. So I've spent my life in science, and there is no better way for us to figure out what's going on in the universe. I mean, we've been able to create the net and wipe out polio and smallpox and launch ships to the moon. Science is essentially the greatest thing that we've got. The issue is when you spend a life in science and you walk down the pier of science, at some point you reach the end of that pier and you realize that beyond that is everything else, all the uncharted waters, all the stuff that we don't know about. And scientists are actually quite good at appreciating the vastness of their ignorance. This is what we do as scientists. We realize where the limits are, and we realize all the things we don't know, and we're comfortable holding multiple hypotheses in our head at the same time and saying, well, maybe beyond the end of the pier, maybe it's this, maybe it's that. And that's sort of what we do day to day. That's the scientific temperament,
right?
Is this tolerance for ideas and this creativity.
Talk about multiple possibilities. You've got 40 here, and those out of many more, as I understand, that you envisioned along the way. I mean, it's sort of funny to hear you remind us that these are not real proposals about the afterlife. Of course, who the heck knows what's real about the afterlife? Even if you have religious beliefs, there are an awful lot of details that never get filled in. You cut it six ways to Sunday here. God is a woman. God's a married couple. We are God's internal organs. Or many others where God may or may not even show up somewhere. In the very first one, the sort of title story here, Some of the of an Afterlife, the afterlife is just our lives, but, well, describe it for us. It's like all similar activities clustered together. So the
right.
Sort of diversity of days is vanquished. We do everything we did in life all at once. We clip our toenails for 6 days, all in one stretch, and then we grieve over lost relatives for all in one stretch. And what does that look like?
Right. So the idea is that if you took all of your life's experiences and you reshuffled them so that all the moments that share a quality are grouped together, then, yeah, you'd spend 15 months looking for lost items and, you take a 200-day shower. And
you're right. In this part of the afterlife, you imagine something, and imagine, as in looking back on it, something analogous to your earthly life, and the thought is blissful, a life where episodes are split into tiny, swallowable pieces, where moments do not endure, where one experiences the joy of jumping from one event to the next, like a child hopping from spot to spot on the burning sand. It's not the only imagined afterlife that looks back on earthly life with a kind of great nostalgia and even preference, David.
Well, yeah, I think when you look at traditional religious stories about the afterlife, what you find is they're goofy in 100 ways. What you find is when you really start examining stories about the afterlife, I think you would have a nostalgia for your earthly life. So, for example, in some of those afterlives, you end up, one of them is you pay to get downloaded. You pay to get your consciousness downloaded into this great place with fast cars and electric pumping cityscapes and sake and sushi and so on. But what happens is it turns out there really is a god, and you end up on a cloud with harp music, and it's maddeningly slow, and you realize you're stuck there for eternity in an ill-fitting toga, and there's nothing to do, and you're stuck there. I think there are a lot of versions of heaven. When you look at them, you realize that it actually wouldn't make a great place or a lot of sense. In one of the stories, Prism, God runs into a problem where he realizes he doesn't know what age to make people in the afterlife. Should you make this old lady look the way she did at her moment of death, or do you make her as she was in her prime as a young woman, but then she's not recognizable to her own granddaughter, and so on?
And so he decides to let everyone take all their ages, be all of their ages at once in the afterlife. And it turns out they barely recognize one another. The 70-year-old me or whoever, the heart doesn't really relate to the 20-year-old, doesn't relate to the 40-year-old. It's an infinite number of different people at the different ages we had lived.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And this is something that I'd been thinking about as a neuroscientist for a while, is this illusion of continuity, which is you think of yourself as the same person that you were as, let's say, a 12-year-old. But in fact, if your 12-year-old you walked into the room right now, you would have more in common with your colleagues than you would with that 12-year-old. Since we have the same name and the same history and resume and so on, you sort of think it's the same you. But in some sense, you drift as you age.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are imagining this hour the afterlife with a neuroscientist who has pictured it dozens of ways many you will never have thought of. David Eagleman joins us from Houston, Texas. He's author of the new book, Sum, S-U-M, 40 Tales from the Afterlives. You can read an excerpt on our website, onpointradio.org. He's a working neuroscientist and big-time neuroscientist at Houston's Baylor College of Medicine. He's director of the Laboratory for Perception and Action, the Initiative on Neuroscience and Law. His book, Sum, is kind of literature, kind of philosophy, and though he sort of denies it, it is kind of speculation about what may be out there, though it reflects directly on what's right here. David, let me get a call right away from Lisa in Salt Lake City, Utah. Lisa, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my phone call. I appreciate it.
Yeah. What do you think?
One thing I've always thought about was how we've all been fetuses in utero, and then we are born and we go through this doorway, and when we're in utero, whatever consciousness we have has no idea what's coming next. And that's the way I've always thought about the afterlife. There's a doorway that we are all going to go through eventually. We have no idea what it is, but to me it's the next adventure, just from going from a fetus to this consciousness after death. There'll be another doorway, and then we'll have to kind of see how that adventure will play out.
Birth canal is doorway number one, grave is doorway number two, or something like that.
And then maybe there's doorway number three and doorway number four. I mean, the universe and the God energy is huge and unknowable, and I think it's very difficult to think about it with our very limited capacity. Now that I've said that, I'm Jewish, and... Uh-huh. One of the things that I've been studying a little bit is Gilgul Neshama, which is the recycling of souls. And the way that I interpret that is that we go back to an energy, whether that's you perceive that as a God energy or a universal energy, but almost like physics, conservation of mass. You know, so I have somewhere between a Jewish perspective and a physics perspective about what might happen to me on the afterlife. But the bottom line is I'll wait and see.
Lisa, it's great. Thank you very much for that. David, there's a lot there. But first, what about this parallel? Lisa thinks about, you know, the fetus coming through the birth canal to life and imagines a parallel with humans passing toward death. As a neuroscientist, how do you hear that metaphor?
I have no idea if that's right or not. I'm not really making proposals for what I think the afterlife is, but Lisa hit exactly on the right point, which is about our limited capacity to know a lot of things. And And that's essentially where I'm coming from as a scientist writing this fiction book, is it's just a celebration of our limited capacity to know things. And when you devote your whole life to science and walking down that pier, what you really develop is that the awe that comes from having such a limited capacity. And so the particular suggestion that Lisa made, I have no idea if that's right or not. I mean, the thing is, we just don't know, right? When you die, it just might be like a long sleep. That's one of the points in the possibility space. There are lots and lots of points in that space of possibilities. And so what I hope to inspire with this book is just the exercise of shining a flashlight around that possibility space. And just what sort of seems to happen in the world now is people commit to a particular religion, whatever their parents have taught them to be true. And so you're offered a very limited number of stories about what we're doing here. And it seems to me a very valuable exercise to mentally stretch and to continue to ask lots of questions and understand the degree to which we don't know things.
Well, you definitely do that. Read us another. You've got one angst in here where,
okay.
We'll get the idea in a hurry, but it's kind of a reverse of many expectations. Talk about a different way of looking at things. It's just a vignette. Let's hear it.
Okay, angst. As humans, we spend our time seeking big, meaningful experiences. So the afterlife may surprise you when your body wears out. We expand back into what we really are, which is, by Earth standards, enormous. We stand 10,000 kilometers tall in each of 9 dimensions and live with others like us in a celestial commune. When we reawaken in these, our true bodies, we immediately begin to notice that our gargantuan colleagues suffer a deep sense of angst. Our job is the maintenance and upholding of the cosmos. Universal collapse is imminent, and we engineer wormholes to act as structural support. We labor relentlessly on the edge of cosmic disaster. If we don't execute our jobs flawlessly, the universe will re-collapse. Ours is complex, intricate, and important work. After 3 centuries of this toil, we have the option to take a vacation. We all choose the same destination. We project ourselves into lower dimensional creatures. We project ourselves into the tiny, delicate, 3-dimensional bodies that we call humans, and we are born onto the resort we call Earth. The idea on such vacations is to capture small experiences. On the Earth, we care only about our immediate surroundings. We watch comedy movies. We drink alcohol and enjoy music. We form relationships, fight, break up, and start again. When we're in a human body, we don't care about universal collapse. Instead, we care only about a meeting of the eyes, a glimpse of bare flesh, the caressing tones of a loved voice, joy, love, light, the orientation of a houseplant, the shade of a paint stroke, the arrangement of hair. Those are good vacations that we take on Earth, replete with our little dramas and fusses. The mental relaxation is unspeakably precious to us. And when we're forced to leave by the wearing out of those delicate little bodies, it is not uncommon to see us lying prostrate in the breeze of the solar winds, tools in hand, looking out into the cosmos, wet-eyed, searching for meaninglessness.
David Eagleman, reading from Some 40 Tales from the Afterlife, and there's one. Earth is the big Club Med, the big vacation. We're actually gigantic, entities who hold up the cosmos and long, every 300 years, longing for a little Earth time to get away from it all.
Yeah, exactly.
I love it. Carl, Conway, South Carolina, you're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi, Carl.
Hi.
Well, thanks for taking my call. That's so awesome. I just wanted to share this idea I had that I formulated like maybe 3 seconds after I heard your first vignette.
Okay.
And the idea is that every single human being throughout the entire course of their entire existence, all their memories, all the interactions that they have, all the interactions that they have that impact everyone else that they ever meet or ever don't meet.
Okay.
Is just one expression or perception of the grand logical construct that would be what reality actually is.
cosmic, dude.
Yeah, that's what the lady said. She said
no. Well, I mean, but that's exactly where we try and stretch and go when we try and stretch past the boundary of life. What do you say, David?
Well, I'm not sure I followed it. Maybe you could just try it from a different angle, Carl, so I can follow it.
It's not easy getting over this this line. Give us more, Carl.
Okay, maybe in terms of the afterlife. I like the idea that, you know, your afterlife consists of everyone that you may ever have met, and, you know, you only know in the afterlife what you ever knew while you were living. Mm-hmm. But I think that each person is just one range of how many people you could know, or, man, it's so complicated. I don't even know I know how, like, if I understand it.
It's exactly what happens when we unfurl our flag out in that direction. Yeah, and Carl, thanks. David, you must hear this all the time. People really, when they think about it, when they get focused, and Lord knows we don't for days and months and maybe years, but when they do, they really want to try and stretch out and feel something of a reality that they can imagine, touch.
Well, that's the point of the book, and I hope more people do. I mean, as it stands now, civilization spends a lot of time fighting over a pitifully few number of stories that have been passed down from our ancestors. And these things matter for education and legislation and our civilization. It matters to stretch out and to think, you know, there's a lot we don't know, and maybe I can make up this story, or maybe I can make up that story instead of battling over the ones that we've been handed. So, you know, I applaud Carl on working to stretch into some new space there.
Tell
That's
us,
the idea.
You talked, I think, earlier about Great Expectations, the title of one of your imaginings here. Now, what was that again?
Oh, that's the one where there's a company that allows you to download your consciousness. And so you pay good money for this, and they essentially destroy you with a laser and recreate you in zeros and ones in a computer. But the problem is no one's ever been able to prove that it works. And what happens is you pay your money and they destroy you with the laser, and then you find yourself in heaven after all. And everybody there is disappointed because they've just paid good money for this afterlife of their own choosing. And so God finds himself in a very awkward position where all these people are showing up on these cloudscapes, and they're disappointed about being there. And so God says to them, your fantasies have cursed your realities. And he says to them, the company offered you no evidence that it would work. Why did you believe them? And then the last line of the story is, although he doesn't say it, everyone knows what he's thinking when he retires to his bed at night, that one of his best gifts, the ability to have faith in an unseen hereafter, has backfired.
Poor God, you just can't satisfy these humans.
Yeah.
There's another one, Ineffable. I wonder if you can read for us. A very different take, if you could, David.
Okay, Ineffable. When soldiers part ways at war's end, the breakup of the platoon triggers the same emotion as the death of a person. It is the final bloodless death of the war. This same mood haunts actors on the drop of the final curtain. After months of working together, something greater than themselves has just died. After a store closes its doors on its final evening, or a Congress wraps its final session, the participants amble away, feeling that they were part of something larger than themselves, something they intuit had a life, even though they can't quite put a finger on it. In this way, death is not only for humans, but for everything that existed. And it turns out that anything which enjoys life enjoys an afterlife. Platoons and plays and stores and congresses do not end, they simply move on to a different dimension. They are things that were created and existed for a time, and therefore, by the cosmic rules, they continue to exist in a different realm. Although it is difficult for us to imagine how these beings interact, they enjoy a delicious afterlife together, exchanging stories of their adventures. They laugh about good times and often, just like humans, lament the brevity of life. The people who constituted them are not included in their stories. In truth, they have as little understanding of you as you have of them. They generally have no idea you existed. It may seem mysterious to you that these organizations can live on without the people who composed them. But the underlying principle is simple. The afterlife is made of spirits. After all, you do not bring your kidney and liver and heart to the afterlife with you. Instead, you gain independence from the pieces that make you up. A consequence of this cosmic scheme may surprise you. When you die, you are grieved by all the atoms of which you were composed. They hung together for years, whether in sheets of skin or communities of spleen. With your death, they do not die. Instead, your atoms part ways, moving off in their separate directions, mourning the loss of a special time they shared together, haunted by the feeling that they were once playing parts in something larger than themselves, something that had its own life, something they can hardly put a finger on.
I just love that. Not so self-centered. It's the atoms. They got together to be you, us, for a time, and
yeah,
they're the ones feeling nostalgic when they wander off the communal project of each individual in the afterlife. Let's go to Lou in Buffalo, New York. Lou, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate it. You know, you've got a lot of heavy thinkers going on here so far. I'm a raised and practicing Catholic. And, you know, here's my thought on all this.
Okay.
You know how you didn't know anything? You didn't know anything at all before you were born? My worry is that once you die, that's what's going to happen again. You're just not going to know anything. It's just going to be nothing.
But let me ask you, as a practicing Catholic, don't you have some teaching from the Church about what to expect? And does it really sound like nothingness to you?
Yes, that's the dilemma. That's the dilemma. As I'm now 58 years old and getting older, that's the dilemma I'm worried about. I mean, you know, I pray and I go to church and I talk. I try to get some guidance and information and trust, and yet there is that lingering doubt.
Yep. Well, what you suggested about losing everything, that's one point in the possibility space. That's certainly one of the things that might happen. The issue for me as a scientist is we don't have, as I mentioned before, science is this incredibly successful tool that we leverage for things. And we've been able to do so much with it. But there are many things that we just don't have the tools for, or I should say the tools of science don't apply to those domains. And so when you get to the end of the pier, you realize there's a lot past the ending, and we will continue to build out that pier a few slats in each generation. But the issue for me is, in my brief twinkling of a 21st century lifetime, mm-hmm. we're not going to get that far, right? There's still mm-hmm. uncharted waters as far as the eye can see. And so, as I started to mention, the reason for writing this book is because of the tremendous success of these new atheist books, which are great books, by the way. But I, what I've been afraid of is it gives the misimpression that scientists are not able to go beyond the available data and speculate about things. But it turns out that is the heart of a scientific career. It's to say, okay, well, here's all the stuff we don't know. So it could be this, it could be that. And we hold these hypotheses in our heads. And if there's no reason to privilege one story over the other stories, then you don't. We don't. I think we're very comfortable as scientists not having certainty about things. And when we, part of the scientific temperament is we don't need to have this notion of truth or certainty. All we ever have in science is the weight of the evidence, and for many things, there's no evidence available at all. And so we have to be comfortable with the ambiguity, which is the terms on which we have our relationship with Mother Nature. Beauty, talent, fame, money, refinement, upskill, and brain. But all the things you try to hide will be revealed on the other side. In the afterlife, we never fall a serious fight. Now you make the scene of the darkness, but tomorrow the afterlife will be right. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're imagining the afterlife this hour with a neuroscientist who has pictured it dozens of ways many you will never have thought of. David Eagleman is with us from Houston, Texas. He's a neuroscientist at Houston's Baylor College of Medicine and author of the new book, Some, S-U-M, 40 Tales from the Afterlives. You can read a little bit at our website, onpointradio.org. Lots of people have thought about it, made art and films and monologues about it. Here's a monologue from British comedian Rowan Atkinson playing the devil, welcoming newcomers to hell.
Hello. It's nice to see you all here. Now, as the more perceptive of you probably realized by now, this is hell. And I am the devil. Good evening. But you can call me Toby, if you like. We try to keep things informal here, as well as infernal. That's just a little joke of mine.
The devil, Rowan Atkinson there. In 1997, his film Deconstructing Harry, Woody Allen's character meets his own father in hell and asks the devil to let him go.
I forgive him. What's over is over. It's finished. Well, let him go to heaven, please.
I'm a Jew. We don't believe in heaven.
Where do you want to go?
To a Chinese restaurant.
Take him to Joy Luck. I love him despite everything.
Take him to the Chinese restaurant and off we go. Let's go to Usha in Providence, Rhode Island. Usha, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
I just wanted to make a comment. I grew up in a home. My parents are born-again Christians, and I grew up where heaven and hell were discussed in our household every day as an absolute reality. And as a child, it was so clear to me that it was against everything that life teaches. Life is about circles, about learning lessons, about growing, cycles. And to get to heaven where everything is stagnant was completely against what life was about, and it made no sense to me. And I was terrified of the idea of heaven as a little kid. Just the thought of being in one place forever and everything was perfect was just terrifying. As an adult, I've come to, you know, find my own path, and I believe in reincarnation. But I just wanted to share how I think the idea of heaven is so against the idea of life.
As you see it, and you got a reincarnating view there. David, how about it?
I think Usha's highlighting something that a lot of people feel, which is that the stories that are passed down to us are kind of limited in certain ways. In one of my stories, Egalitaire, I address this issue that God starts suffering over the fact that she set up the system so that there's a heaven and a hell, and that she's forced to make this binary categorization of people as good or evil. And she, because she's sort of a deep thinker, starts realizing that people are a lot more complicated than that. And she's hearing prayers from both sides of a war. And anyway, so she finally decides that she can't abide by those childish rules that she had set up a long time ago about categorizing people into good and evil, because people are much more multifaceted than that. And in a lot of the stories in this book, it's addressing the issues of sort of the very simple-mindedness of the stories that were handed down to us. One of the most important
I love
things,
if I may, just in mm-hmm. Egalitaire, God, she in this particular story, eventually says, you know, sort of the heck with it, I'll just bring everyone to heaven. I can't sort them out in black and white so easily. I'll bring everyone to heaven, and then everybody's miserable. Let me read just a little bit from your last graphs here. Everyone's in heaven, but the communists are baffled and irritated because they finally achieved their perfect society, but only by the help of a God in whom they don't want to believe. The meritocrats are abashed that they're stuck for eternity in an incentiveless system with a bunch of pinkos. The conservatives have no penniless to disparage. The liberals have no downtrodden to promote. Everyone's in heaven. And you write, so God sits on the edge of her bed and weeps at night because the only thing everyone can agree upon is that they're all in hell. No thanks to the egalitarian thing there.
Yes. Just to continue with this point, the philosophers Russell and Whitehead a long time ago said, look, if you want to have some sort of spirituality of any sort, it really would make sense to predicate it on what we already know. So, you know, in the 21st century, we have such an incredible amount of science at our fingertips to draw from. And the stories that are passed down to us traditionally are written by people thousands of years ago who didn't know about DNA or biological algorithms or computers or microbes or any of this stuff. And in fact, they didn't really have much of an opportunity to travel even to neighboring cultures and see other things. So it was sort of a limited point of view. And our point of view is very broad now. And so the idea is, why not incorporate all that stuff into our ideas? So you saw, for example, in Angst, I'm addressing this point that, you know, mm-hmm. we now know that space is not just the three dimensions we see, but it's somewhere between 9 and 13 extra spatial dimensions that we don't have access to. So I thought, oh, wouldn't that be cool to make a story predicated on that? And, you know, your body's made up of 30 trillion trillion atoms. And I thought, wow, that would be a great thing to make a story on. That was the story where all your atoms lament your passing. And so on. And so, in some sense, this book is a vehicle for exploring ideas, again, none of which are meant to be taken seriously, but it's a vehicle for exploring ideas based on what we already know to be true. And
Since it's still off the end of the pier of understanding, you can't help but wonder if ultimately it's any more insightful than the folks who sat around 5,000 years ago trying to imagine what was out there.
Sure. I mean, the possibility space is vast. But what I want to emphasize is the exercise of swinging that flashlight around the possibility space and really thinking about some new sorts of stories.
Love it. Love it. Ileana in White River Junction, Vermont, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Hello,
Hi.
David.
Hi.
Hello.
First of all, I have to say I'm completely delighted that this beautiful scientific mind is taking this wonderfully creative approach to thinking about the afterlife. And I'm also delighted because all my life I've had what I call my theories of heaven. Two little short ones are, I think heaven is like everybody that has gone before you, the people that you miss. They're hanging out in this fabulous afterlife, and they're like, when is Ileana going to get here? They look at their watches. And the other one, which is actually one that I kind of hope for more, because all of these, I think, are just ways of imposing our creative input on the unknown.
Mm-hmm.
And so the second one, it's that basically when you die, you know that feeling when you learn something new and there's this, oh yeah, of understanding?
Sure.
I imagine that it would be a really great afterlife if that's what it was all about. It was just this endless grasping of things. I mean, some things trivial, some things important. But yeah, I just think it's a gorgeous program, and I'm kind of post-religious at this point, if not completely post-spiritual, but...
But you're right in the spirit of it there, Ileana. That's great. David?
Yeah, so I just want to address this post-religious thing. It's, a lot of people get frustrated with the stories passed down, and so they end up saying that they're an atheist. And as I mentioned, I can't exactly commit to atheism because there's so much that we don't know. There's such a vast, complex unknown out there that it doesn't make sense for me to do that. It doesn't make sense for me to commit to anybody's particular idiosyncratic story either, because those have problems. And so a lot of people find themselves sort of in this middle position. Now, sometimes people use agnostic for that, but I find that a very weak term because usually when someone says I'm an agnostic, what they mean is, I'm not sure if the guy with the beard on the white cloud exists or doesn't exist. That's what they often mean by it.
You call yourself a possibilian.
Exactly right. So I call myself a possibilian, which is all about appreciating the enormity of the possibility space. And I was on NPR last week, and I mentioned possibilianism. And I've gotten hundreds of emails. It turns out that now it seems to be something like a real movement because I think... somehow it's an idea that appeals to a lot of people to say, look, I'm not going to commit to a particular thing and I'm not going to say there's nothing. Instead, I'm interested in the exploration and thinking about new ideas. And so, I've actually seen in the last week, possibilianism spread all around the net. But what's very funny is that everybody's come up with their own terms for it. So not only have people talked about possibilianism, but now I've heard people referring to possibilitarians and possibilist. Someone said probabilist to me the other day because they just heard it once on the radio
right.
And then forgot.
It's rich. We've got so many more callers, but I want to hear a few more of your stories if we can. Give us, for example, metamorphosis. Just in essence, what's that vision? You don't have to read us the whole thing. We may not have time, but in a nutshell.
I'll just read you the first line then.
Mm-hmm.
There are three deaths. The first is when the body ceases to function. The second is when the body is consigned to the grave. The third is that moment, sometime in the future, when your name is spoken for the last time. So you wait in this lobby until the third death. And it's all about this lobby where you have tea and cookies and so on. It's like an infinite airport waiting area. And you're waiting for the last person to remember your name, and then you get to go on to the next place.
And so, actually, as you describe it there, Some people get tired of being remembered. They want to ultimately, you know, let go of me. Stop remembering me. Let me get out of this transit lounge.
Exactly. These are the famous people who are remembered. Sometimes people are remembered for unfair reasons, like, you know, they drown in a river and their story is told each month.
Right. Though in one of the others, you have people in the afterlife able to look back into life, see what they want to see, and all they care about is the ways in which they left some track there. They're obsessed with looking back on their tracks in the sand.
That's right. In that story, you're in this giant television lounge. The walls are made up of television monitors, and all you're doing is watching the future and, yeah, trying to see the ripples that you've left in your wake. And it turns out that if you watch those television screens long enough into the future, you find that everything changes, and you find that Moses and Jesus and Muhammad go the way of Osiris and Zeus and Thor, and all the people that you love and know, they all die, and so on. And so it turns out that it's the sinners that are cursed to watch the whole future, and the people who are good end up getting insulated from it and don't have to watch the televisions.
Let's go to Cinda in Rockport, Massachusetts. Cinda, you're on the air.
Yes, Tom. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, David, what a wonderful theories of your book. Just wonderful. I'm a Christian. I've been studying God's Word since I was a little girl. I also am writing a book called The Journey's End, and it's about returning to our first love. I have studied the Bible for a long, long time, and I believe that what Jesus has told us is the truth because I believe in the Bible, and I believe it's God's Word, and it tells us exactly where we are going to be when we die.
But let's hear that. So then you believe dust to dust and the resurrection of souls, but once resurrected, what then? What do you see?
Well, I believe, not what I believe, what God has told us, that we do die our natural physical selves die and go dust to dust and sleep and unconscious. We are unconscious until Jesus comes back and our spiritual selves are resurrected. And our souls are our natural selves, but our spiritual selves are resurrected and we live and we are judged accordingly.
But live how and where? How do you picture that part of the story, Cinda?
Well, I'm just going with the Bible says. The Bible tells it all, and I'm going with the Bible.
That's fine. But in that resurrected state, do you try and imagine, you know, the texture of it, or is that just you're satisfied with that as a kind of a blank joy?
We are as Jesus because Jesus was the first born into the resurrection. So we will be born as Jesus was into the resurrection, and how we have lived our lives in, you know, into being believing in God and his source. And
but could that state have television screens on the wall and so
Tom,
on?
Tom, could I jump in and address something?
Yeah.
Okay. So Cindy, thank you for that comment. And it may be right. I mean, maybe that's exactly what happens. The trouble that I see in some of these issues is there are 2,000 religions on the earth, and they all believe very fervently in their own story. And I mentioned this earlier, but Dawkins points out that everybody knows what it's like to be an atheist, because all you need to do is look at somebody else's religious belief and you think, well, that's patently untrue. That can't be right. So the question is, the story that you told might be right, and it's obviously one that you believe in, and that's great. But there are people who would look at your story and say, well, that's clearly not true, and instead my story is true. And they believe that as fervently, exactly to the same degree that you believe yours. And so the problem for somebody like me who's looking at it from the outside thinks, well, you know, gee, how would you choose among these different stories? And so the idea, and I, as I said, I think it's important for the way that we vote and pass rules and teach our children. The idea is, you know, there are lots of ideas out there, and maybe it's okay to be comfortable with different ideas coexisting.
I'm fascinated by how there are blanks even within belief systems, places to be kind of imagined. Molly, one more in Belmont, Massachusetts. Molly, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I am a holistic psychotherapist, a poet, and a storyteller, and I am so happy to hear you celebrating what we don't know. Robert Bly once told a story about a traveler traveling all over the world. He reached an ancient village in Africa, and everybody was throwing flower petals up into the air, thousands and thousands of flower petals. And finally, the traveler asked the chief, "Why are you throwing flower petals up into the air?" And he said, "Because we know nothing about God, and we are celebrating what we don't know." And then Robert Bly paused, and he said, Now, when we don't understand anything about God, we get depressed. And being a therapist, I'm trying to give this message to my clients all day long about celebrating what we don't know instead of getting depressed over it.
Molly, our time is short, but thank you so much. Neuroscientist Eagleman, will we ever know? We've just got a minute here. Do you will the peer at some point pierce even this veil? Will we know?
So each generation, we keep building the peer out. Science is an incredibly productive enterprise. I just don't think in our lifetime we will, certainly we won't get to the end of the uncharted waters with any of our lifetime. And so,
forget lifetime. What about ever? Is it pierceable?
I have no idea. I mean, it's impossible to know how far that peer will get us. But it is possible that there are some things that are totally beyond the tools of science. So, so I think throwing petals up in the air and celebrating all the things that we don't know is fantastic. And in some sense, that's what the heart of a scientific career is. It's going into that and saying, wow, there's such vast complexity and unknown out there. I'm going to spend my life studying it.
Good for Molly. Good for Cinda. Good for all the imaginations and believers at work and talking with us. In this hour, David Eagleman's new book is Some 40 Tales from the Afterlives. Thank you very much, David. Thanks for your wonderful imagination. So many stories we didn't even get to here, but maybe in the fullness of time, we will. Maybe we'll live them or after live them. Thanks.
Thank you, Tom.
Great to have you here. Great to have you. David Eagleman joining us today from Houston, Texas, where he's a neuroscientist at Houston's Baylor College of Medicine. We'll go out with Bob Dylan, Trying to Get to Heaven. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
I've been to Sugar Town, I shook the sugar down. Now I'm trying to get to heaven.